Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Well, good afternoon and welcome along to the programme. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for the next hour and a half for Unbelievable. It's the programme that aims to get you thinking every Saturday afternoon as we bring Christians and non-Christians together. And today is no exception to that, as we're going to be hearing from an atheist blogger who converted recently, be finding out why, and a response. But before we get into all of that, let me just remind you that if you don't already know about it, Unbelievable the Conference 2012 is on DVD. In fact, three DVDs. You can buy the set for the paltry cost of £20 for over 10 hours of material. Ready to go now if you want to get online and order your copy. premier.org.uk/DVD. Six fabulous speakers. I was presenting the conference that happened with about 600 in attendance. So if you missed it, if you were there and you simply couldn't get to all the seminars, you'll want to get online and order that. Some great summer viewing. premier.org.uk/DVD. Also, just want to flag up something I'm going to be talking about later on in the show. In the feedback section, I'm going to be telling you about the Atheist Prayer Experiment, something a little different that we're going to be doing in conjunction with this programme. Find out more about the Atheist Prayer Experiment. Are you an atheist? You may want to take part. So listen out later on in the programme for more details on that. For the moment, time to get into today's discussion.
You're unbelievable.
Well, it's my great pleasure to welcome onto today's show Leah Labresco and Hemant Mehta. Leah is the atheist blogger who converted to Catholicism recently. She ran the blog Unequally Yoked until June this year when she announced that she was converting to Catholicism. Well, she's still blogging, but this time as a Catholic. Why? Well, she says because of the force of the moral argument for the existence of God, and her announcement caused a lot of chatter on the atheist and Christian blogosphere. Well, she's here to talk to us about that whole experience, and joining us also for this conversation, still an atheist blogger, Hemant Mehta, also known as the Friendly Atheist, with a blog of the same name. Hemant once spent a year attending churches after selling his soul to Christians on eBay. It didn't persuade him to change his mind, so he's going to be interacting with Leah to find out what exactly changed her mind. So I hope you enjoy today's show, and let me first of all say to you, Leah, thank you very much for joining me today.
Well, thanks so much for inviting me.
It's been really interesting to hear about your story. I mean, it's caused quite a lot of a stir. You even went on to CNN. So tell us a little bit of the backstory to this, though. Were you raised in any kind of a religious upbringing, or was that something that you really weren't, as it were, brought up with?
No, I grew up on Long Island in New York, where almost everyone I knew was secular Jews. So I didn't really meet any Christians who talked in a particularly intellectual way about being Christian until I went to college. My experience is mostly the hardcore Christian right in politics, which tends to be anti-intellectual. When I went to college, I joined a philosophical debating group, which tended to be split between libertarians and trad Catholics.
Okay.
And started having a lot of fights with people, and was surprised by how much better their arguments were than I expected.
And so when you came along to these particular philosophical debates, etc., you kind of came with an assumption of atheism of some kind?
Oh, yes. I had to do kind of more reading because I was pretty sure I was right, but my arguments weren't as persuasive as they should be, so I thought I needed to understand the other side better so I could kind of get in and debunk it.
Mm. So tell me about what happened in the process. I understand part of the story was that you started to date someone who was a Catholic, hence the title of your blog, Unequally Yoked.
Yes, I was dating a nice Catholic boy, and I made a deal that I would go to Mass with him on Sundays if he would go to ballroom dance class with me, which I figured couldn't help but be a good deal for me because he couldn't help learning the steps. And we'd have a lot of arguments, and one thing that was kind of surprising is we were very in sync on a lot of moral questions, but then not so much on the metaphysical grounding for the morals we'd ended up with.
Absolutely. So this obviously started a journey of questioning. You carried on in this vein of sort of having conversations for quite a long time, didn't you? What was the process by which you started to, I guess, question some of the most deeply held beliefs you had, or non-beliefs, you might say?
Well, the main problem was that I had some beliefs, you know, about things that were right or wrong, better or worse dispositions to take towards behaving morally. I ended up switching from deontology, where you think of morality as kind of a rule book that you're meant to follow and you have a duty to follow, to virtue ethics, where you think about morality as a way of shaping character, where you're trying to make it as natural as possible to behave morally, not just sort of behaving out of rigid duty. And during that process, you know, I came in for a lot of criticism by some of my atheist friends in our debating group, a lot of whom were postmodernists, for arguing, you know, that morality was objective, for arguing that we could make strong moral claims. And they'd say, well, where on earth are you getting that from? Are you getting that, you know, from strict naturalism, because you can't do that, you know? Where do you get off saying that, you know, there's a particular way humans ought to be? And I didn't have such a good reply to them in my atheist framework, so I was trying to work on coming up with a better one.
So at the same time, your Catholic friends presumably were needling you as to whether you had a consistent worldview and all the rest of it. And eventually something had to give, I guess?
Essentially, you know, it was, what do I have the most confidence in? And that's that morality is objective, is accessible to humans in some way. It's like mathematics in that it's, you know, this abstract thing that we don't have direct access to but are able to make fairly accurate pronouncements about. But unlike mathematics, which is at least kind of embedded in the real world, you can imagine from seeing this collection of two cups and two knives, oh, the thing they have in common is two-ness, if you want to go with the Platonic view of that. It was less clear how you bootstrapped your way up to an understanding of immaterial morality. And what I ended up thinking, you know, Christianity posed an answer, but it was hard for me to check whether it was a true answer, whether they had kind of just made something up. You know, you run into the same problem I do, you come up with a answer, if not necessarily an accurate one. I was looking for a way to test it. And ultimately, what kind of convinced me is that something I'd kind of always seen as irrelevant to the claim about how morality works, that, you know, morality is linked to some kind of agent, in this case God, turned out to kind of solve the problem neatly in a way that surprised me, that morality could reach back to people, that it's not sort of this abstract, distant thing that humans happen to stumble on, but something that takes an interest in us, that's accessible to us by force of its will. And, you know, having thought it was plausible but not true, seeing something that I saw as kind of irrelevant or an interesting embroidery on how do you get to moral law end up being the center of an explanation was surprising and exciting.
Sure. It is a fascinating conversion story, you know, probably not typical of many people, though I know a number who would say that this was certainly part of their journey, grappling with these questions. Now, of course, when you blogged back in June, this is my last post as an atheist, that really took a lot of people by surprise, not least because, well, it may be one thing to, you know, have questions and start to become convinced by something along the lines of what you've been describing, the moral argument for the existence of God. But it was the fact that you converted to Catholicism per se, and that's taken a lot of people by surprise. So just help us by giving a bit of background to why particularly you felt comfortable embracing Catholicism at that point.
Well, there are a number of reasons, one of which is just that, you know, the structure of Catholicism throws everyone into the same boat together, and it means that you've got to fight everything out with each other, which both seems true in terms of what you would expect from a universal religion, and I like quite a bit. One thing I always like about democracy is it makes me personally responsible to everyone else in the democracy, even beyond any moral obligations I have to them, because if they're in error, they get to vote, and they can really screw me over if I don't have an interest in what they're thinking. And the idea that you can just, that you're free to schism and split from the church means that you're abandoning the people that you think, you know, by the fact that you're schisming, are in grave error, which seems like a failure of charity. When I move to Canada, you know, when I lose elections, I'm abandoning people who I have some kind of responsibility to. So just the claim of the Catholic Church to be small c Catholic, to be very insistent that people stay in the church, pick fights if they have to, but that they all have to remain bound together, made a lot of sense to me. And there are other parts of the tradition that I've encountered a lot through Chesterton that also rang true.
I think we'll come back to this, but as I read your blog, it seemed obvious, yes, that people like Chesterton, Lewis, and others had an influence in that journey. I know that Hemant is going to want to comment on a lot of this as well, and we will be coming to Hemant Mehta shortly for his interactions on this. But another area that I think we should just cover briefly, at least before we go to the discussion, is the way the atheist online community reacted. What was the general tenor of the way people reacted to this announcement by yourself?
Well, it varied a lot. You know, people had been reading my blog for a while. Some people didn't find it that surprising. You know, they thought I'd kind of gone wrong long before the conversion, you know, the virtue ethics or something else. They go, well, given that you think this, your conversion is logically could follow from that, but your error was like back three steps ago and you should go fix it, you know, and that's fine. And we've been having that argument essentially for, you know, several months to a year anyway. Some people were kind of drive-by commenters who had found it through other links, never read my stuff before. You know, were a lot more hostile because when you're on the internet, it's not like you're talking to a person. You just read one post and go, this was stupid. I don't find this one post convincing. You know, I bet you had a stroke. And that's just, honestly, more than anything else, a waste of their time. You know, they're not, you know, for someone who, you know, read a 1,000-word post by me and didn't find it persuasive, I don't know why they think I'm going to find their 50-word comment devastating. So, you know, there are people who've made, like, more substantive critiques, and I've tried to engage with them, and I found them interesting. When people just come by to vent spleen, it's just, you know, them, like, running by and making a silly face and running away, and I don't really care.
We've got some questions that I asked our audience to send in, and we've had some in, Leah, so we'll bring some of those into the course of the conversation as we go on. But thank you for joining me today. Great to have you on the line and talking about this experience. As I mentioned, our other guest on today's programme, Hemant Mehta, a.k.a. The Friendly Atheist. Hemant, thank you very much for joining me as well.
Sure, thank you.
Great to have you. So, Hemant, tell me about your reaction when you heard the story of Leah doing the rounds.
Like you said, I mean, it was surprising to me because I didn't see it coming. But that was, I mean, I think, like you said, my biggest question was just, oh, why Catholicism? Because I guess I could at least understand if she had said, you know, I think maybe God created the world, but beyond that, I don't think so. She didn't. It was a very specific choice about going to Catholicism, which comes with this whole rigid hierarchy and structure. And, you know, I know Leah knows that we have a lot of problems with Catholicism that go far beyond their belief in God. So, I mean, that was the bigger surprise to me, that she chose a specific religion as opposed to kind of a general deist. God kind of started it all and then left. So that was my big surprise. I wasn't I think, like Leah, I wasn't expecting the how big of a story that became.
You did a blog post, I think, along the lines of why all the fuss, basically. I mean, just give us the sense of what you were saying in that blog post.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember if this is what I was saying in that post, but I think, you know, the timing of it was also interesting because, you know, I think a week or two before she had come out as Catholic, You were seeing these polls that said younger people are now doubting religion more often in America. And, you know, more young Americans are becoming atheists. And all of a sudden you had Leah come in and kind of fly in the face of that narrative. So, you know, I remember getting a lot of questions. I started getting questions from reporters saying, you know, what's going on here? Is this a challenge to that trend? Is this just a one-off experience? And, yeah, I mean, to me, yeah, this is just a one-time thing. It's not like Leah was posting about why she became a Catholic, and all of a sudden you saw all these other atheists following her, so to say, off the cliff.
off the cliff.
This was Leah doing something on her own, and, you know, whatever. I don't necessarily agree with her reasoning, but, you know, it's her decision. It, like she said, I guess this has been happening for a while, at least in her head. So, I mean, I wasn't bothered by it, I think, as some people were, but I still can admit that I don't really understand it.
And from your perspective, you think actually the trend is in the other direction. You hear a lot more stories of people leaving religion than joining.
Absolutely. I mean, the sort of story you hear that Leah's talking about happens so rarely. And certainly, if it happens in the public eye, you never see that type of story happen. You know, when it does happen, it's a news story. You know, that's the sort of thing. If a Catholic said they became an atheist, no one would blink an eye. We hear that all the time. But when Leah says she's becoming a Catholic, that is a news story, and I can understand why, because we're not used to hearing that.
Okay, well, let's come back to Leah in a moment. But if you're listening and you'd like to join the conversation, you'd like to give a response, add your voice, then do get in touch. You can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and I look forward to receiving your thoughts on this, and do send them in, and I'll read them out on a future edition of the show to get your responses. Don't forget as well, we're also there on Twitter and Facebook. @unbelievablejb is the Twitter handle. facebook.com/unbelievablejb for the Facebook page, and all those links and many programs and other resources available from the show webpage, premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So we're talking about the atheist blogger who recently converted to Catholicism, Leah Labresco, and she runs the blog. Leah, have you gone for a new name for your blog now? No longer quite as unequally yoked?
Well, honestly, since the boyfriend and I broke up last November, the name has kind of been not accurate for a while, but it sort of became my handle, so I'm sticking with it.
Okay, you're sticking with it. So you can still be found there, and now, as it were, lumped in the atheist section, though, of the Pathos network of blogs. Hemant continues in the atheist section, obviously. But, Leah, I think, you know, this was one of the obvious questions that, and it's come up time and again when I've asked people about their thoughts on your experience. I mean, here's Jonathan, who got in touch via Facebook to say, I'm sure someone will ask, but why did an argument from morality convince her to join a church with a morality so different than her own? Does she have problems with the church's teaching on morality? So this, I mean, we heard what you said, that you do feel actually when you look at it aright, that the Catholic Church, it has a broadness to it that allows people to have fights within the auspices of that church. But a lot of people like Hemant do just say, well, no, come on. When it comes down to it, the Catholic Church believes a rigid set of things, which surely you can't just buy, you know, in one big package and just kind of transplant it all into your belief system. So what's your answer to this, Leah?
Well, I'm sure Hemant will forgive me for using a math analogy, and I don't know what your listeners will think, but in math you have axioms and theorems. You have a set of assumptions that are foundational in geometry, you know, Euclid's four axioms and then the fifth, which is interesting but totally irrelevant to this. I'm not going to go into it. But from there, you try and derive through rules of logic other rules. Now, the thing about Catholicism is sometimes I have questions or arguments about things that are more at the theorem level, where I'm arguing, I don't know that this follows from the foundational things. Like, can you explain to me again why this is important? But I think the axioms are the best set of axioms I've seen for having a moral argument in the first place. Among those axioms, you know, that human beings have a telos, like a purpose, a particular way of being human that is better for them than any other way. That there are certain facilities in humans, you know, the ability to love, the ability to think, that are unique to them, that particularly require cultivation. That weakness is like a gift to others in a way that they get to care for you, where, you know, Stoicism or other things don't think that. And, you know, there are a variety of those ideas that, like, that people have trouble sticking to the straight and narrow, even if they understand that it's true, which is weird, because normally, like, the mark of understanding something is that you can't but do otherwise. Someone who doesn't understand the Pythagorean theorem, or someone who says they don't believe the Pythagorean theorem, means they don't understand it. It's impossible to see a proof and not believe it unless you don't understand it. When we go to morality, you know, people understand they have certain obligations to other people and then don't fulfill them, which is weird, actually. And those foundational ideas, among others, seem more likely to be correct, seem to be the best framework to work within. And then sometimes I argue with people about what you can derive from that framework.
You're actually, though, undergoing now, as I understand it, Leah, the sort of initiation, sort of taking those classes to mm-hmm. to ready yourself for being confirmed within the Catholic Church. I mean, that will involve sort of talking through beliefs about what happens to the sacraments, you know, and we had Richard Dawkins standing up on a stage not long ago telling atheists gathered in Washington to ridicule people who believe that kind of stuff. So what kind of mental thing is happening for you when you're going from a place of not having believed that to believing something happens to the sacraments in communion? Or do you not feel you can yet sign up to that sort of beliefs in this journey?
Well, there's an extent to which those are the less difficult beliefs to sign on to. For one thing, they're harder to, you know, they don't clash against something else in the way I might go, I'm not sure that, you know, this understanding of how the church should interact with the state makes sense for these practical concerns, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas claims about the sacrament have practical consequences but are less likely to run against other practical concerns, since unless you're Catholic, you're not really making any space for them in your epistemology anyway. But one thing that kind of echoes something Chesterton said that I do believe is he was talking about confession to a priest. And people were saying, like, why is it you think, you know, a priest has the power to forgive sins? He goes, why do I think anyone has the power to forgive sins? That's a totally bizarre thing to think, you know. Mm. That this is the mechanism by which it happens is much less surprising to me than the fact that it's capable of happening at all.
Very interesting. Hemant, just feel free now to start interacting. I'm sure you've got plenty of questions you'd like to directly ask Leah. So go ahead.
It's not so much questions that I have. I've heard Leah explain kind of her reason for becoming a Catholic for a while, and I honestly have no idea what she's talking about. I can't explain her line of reasoning to other atheists because I still don't know what she's talking about. And maybe
it's because I'm just why not deism thing, Hemant?
What is that?
Do you want me to hit the why not deism thing? I know you brought that up a bit ago.
Yeah, I think it's hard for me to encapsulate what her reasoning is because from what I can gather, I mean, I think if you have a good argument for turning to religion, you should be able to convince other people and they should be able to follow that line of logic to your conclusion. And that's not happening as far as I'm seeing. So I guess, you know, is there a way, what would your argument be to other atheists as to why they should follow you on your journey?
I mean,
should they also become
the question you asked earlier, and I think that is a good one to respond to at this point, is why not deism? Why not just a sort of, well, okay, I'm prepared to believe in a God in some metaphysical sense in the background and maybe set the universe going, but not this very specific God of Christian revelation. So, yeah, maybe that's a good place to start, Leah.
Right, the why not deism answer is because it's contentless. It doesn't affect how I live my life. It's a hypothesis you add that buys you nothing in terms of predictive ability. And it used to be the case that people went, I don't understand how fire works. And someone went, oh, fire works because of phlogiston, which we've named, and it is called phlogiston, and it means the facility by which fire exists. Naming it something didn't do anything, didn't make any predictions, didn't give you any explanatory power. And deism essentially has that problem. It just goes, well, there's something mysterious here. I've decided to say that there's something called God that explains it, but I won't specify any properties of the God, and I won't specify any consequences that has for how I live my life. And you might as well have not added it. It doesn't change anything you do.
What can you predict now that you couldn't predict before?
So, good question. One thing is that I predict that it is easier than I would otherwise expect for people to come back from doing terrible things. That it is easier for people to kind of hook into a moral framework than I might expect, and that it is, some of this is, this seems improbable, but I've observed it, you know, evolution, this can be part of the argument we have, but evolution favors stability of life over moral reasoning. There are plenty of stable social systems that are completely morally abhorrent. We think, you know, gorillas courting by infanticide is my favorite example because that's pretty awful. And it's weird that humans are relatively accurate and with kind of fairly robust error-checking mechanisms. Now, another prediction I could make, and this one is one I didn't find very satisfying on the other side of this, is just I predict that people who regularly seek out the sacraments will have a more stable life than when they don't. And I observed evidence of that type, but that's a hard...
Say that again, Hemant.
You believe people who observe the sacraments will be more stable as opposed to just a general belief in God, or...?
Yes.
Okay, I mean, I'm not buying it. I don't get. It's still a leap to me to say that I used to be an atheist, but now I believe a communion wafer actually contains the body of Christ. That's a leap of logic that I'm not following.
Let's just take a quick break there, guys. I'm afraid we're coming to the end of our first section. Fascinating stuff we've already got into here. We're talking this afternoon, the atheist blogger who converted to Catholicism recently, made the news out in the States, Leah Labresco's story. She's here to talk to us about that. And there's still an atheist blogger, Hemant Mehta, asking some of the questions on today's programme. So sorry to cut in there, guys. We'll come straight back into this conversation in just a moment's time. This is Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, and we're going to hear more from Leah and Hemant in a moment's time.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, welcome back to today's programme. I'm Justin Brierley, host of Unbelievable, and we're continuing our discussion with Leah Labresco. She is the former atheist blogger, now turned Catholic. She's been explaining her conversion, and in conversation with her is Hemant Mehta, the friendly atheist, also a keen blogger, but he says he just can't understand the reasons for her conversion. So we're going to be continuing this conversation. Just a reminder as well to keep listening out later on for feedback. We're going to be hearing what you've been thinking of the last few weeks of programming, and also news about our forthcoming atheist prayer experiment. That's all to come in today's show. So, coming back to you, Leah, just in that last section, Hemant was asking, it's just a huge leap, isn't it? It's a leap of faith, not of logic, to go from a god of the deist to something that embodies itself in all these very specific ways that as a Catholic, you're obliged to believe. So, you were about to respond to that.
Yeah, so I think one issue here is that we tend to expect one particular kind of standard of evidence is kind of Karl Popper standard, where you make a prediction ahead of time, having no data on how that will turn out, just a hypothesis, test it, see how it comes out, and go, this hypothesis wins, this hypothesis doesn't. Many problems that we feel it's fairly urgent to, have answers to don't admit to that kind of analysis. Like the entire study of statistics, particularly, you know, Bayesian statistics, is going, well, look, we have less data than we'd like to, but we still have to find a way to deal with uncertainty. Now, there are some questions where, you know, it's impossible to step outside the system and set up a test because you're trying to describe the entire system. One example of that would be, you know, how do you rate the probability that you live in an actual physical world with other people versus that you're a Boltzmann brain and everything about this is just, you know, a pattern of electrical circuits that no one else actually exists. You have an image of them. And the answer is, well, you know, I can't test it. Both those explanations cover the data I'd observe. You know, one of them was specifically designed to do that, being the Boltzmann brain example. But you start to ask, you know, well, what would make me think that this was even on the table? You know, that you don't have a good way within the system. You'd need to step outside and observe yourself and the universe together to be able to predict. Now, one thing, I think there are a number of questions where I kind of have to go back to that Boltzmann brain level reasoning rather than like the strict Popper style reasoning. And I'd be curious to know from Hammond, you know, what he thinks grounds his morality when, you know, when you run into someone who's a postmodernist or a nihilist who says, you know, well, why are you saying you have anything except preferences? Why should your preferences be binding on me any more than aesthetic preferences are? I prefer Stephen Sondheim to Andrew Lloyd Webber. Now, I might maintain that's an objectively true thing, but what is it about your preferences that means they're anything more than aesthetic preferences as applied to human action rather than art?
I still have no idea what that question's saying.
Well, I mean...
If you prefer certain art to other art, you wouldn't expect someone else to hew to your preferences.
That's true.
If you prefer certain actions to other actions, you have this expectation that people will share your preferences, that there's something universal that means that they should find those preferences compelling. I mean, you obviously believe that reason, at least, is universal and compelling because you think that I should have an argument that is compelling to all people and, like, a logical thorough put when they read it. Why is it that when it comes to moral questions, you think they're more like reason and less like art?
I'm not sure how to answer that. I don't know that everyone should have the same morality, and I know that they don't, and not everyone's going to agree with my morality versus someone else's. I think you can have good reasons for choosing different paths in that sense.
Well, then what's the heuristic by which you check? Some people, you know, I think we both agree some people have, like, bad things that they value or, you know, misapplied priorities or just actually, you know, value bad things in the case of, the Taliban structure of morality where women are counted as less than human. Is there something that they're missing that means that they're, like, missing out on a fact that would tell them that's not true? Is that an arbitrary distinction and, you know, you just don't share their beliefs but there's not a reason they should share yours?
That women should be treated equally?
That's what I believe. That's what you believe. Like, and right. Some people don't believe that. What's the reason by which they should come to believe what we believe rather than say, oh, people all have different ideas?
What's the reason other than some religious person told them otherwise or they interpreted some holy book as being right so they're just following that step? I mean, I still don't get how we have to deviate from someone who deviates from saying people are treated equally or treated equally.
I suppose what Leah's asking is essentially what grounds your belief in the equality of human beings? What kind of would you point someone to?
I didn't realize that needed justification. I mean, to say that people ought to be treated equally, that we ought to live by that golden rule so we can live a better life, to me, none of that stuff requires justification. To say anything deviated from that, you got to have a really good reason for saying you're superior to someone else, that someone else doesn't deserve the same rights that you do. As soon as you start making claims like that, you better have a good reason for it.
Well, then it sounds like that you believe that there's some, like, universal groundwork of data, metaphysics, whatever you'd like to call it, that should leave everyone to similar conclusions, whether it's just even epistemological modesty. I don't have a reason to think that I'm superior to other people, so I'll act as though we're equal. Is that accurate, that you think there's a universal set of facts about how we should treat other people that everyone has access to? Because it sounds like you're saying people only deviate from that when they're, like, pulled by some external force, like a book or a movement, but their baseline are some of these beliefs that we share.
But it seems like that's the best way to live your life, where, you know, you're no better than anyone else. You're no worse than anyone else. Let's treat people with decency, because that makes for a better life for all of us. And as soon as
the problem is,
some religious leader says, no, we're going to say that men are better than women, and this people who follow this faith are headed for a better afterlife than the people of this faith. As soon as you start making up claims like that,
but what's to say? Why should they not say that your claim is being made up, that all people are equal, Hemant? I mean, this is the point: is that you've got a different opinion to them, and I suppose Leah's just asking you, how would you show someone else that your opinion was the correct opinion? You do believe yours is the correct opinion, the other person is wrong. So upon what basis are you making that judgment? Because, you know, to cut a long story short, this is the thing that is essentially at the core of Leah's conversion, is that there must be a moral lawgiver, let's say. She may not term it that way, and I'll allow her to phrase it, but that at least this fact that we do apprehend this realm of morality, which seems on the face of it to be objective, that there are good reasons why we should believe something and not the other thing, is very difficult to get on an atheist framework. It's very difficult to explain that on an atheist. And I think, from the sounds of it, you're having difficulty explaining it, because you've already referenced the fact, well, it's a better world when we live like this. Well, that's the whole point. How to what standard are you appealing when you say better?
I guess the only standard I'm appealing to is that from the tradition we have, from the history we have, that seems to be a world where people are happiest, where people are doing, where people are treating each other equally. Everyone gets along better. As soon as you start putting other people down, all of a sudden you're setting yourself up for conflict, and that's something religion has done over and over again.
But again, aren't these all value-laden? We're better off. It's a worse world where there's conflict. Leah, I mean,
it's interesting that you're using happiness as kind of the metric, because I think we frequently run into the problem where someone claims to be happy, but we think they're being made happy by the wrong thing. Or, you know, where a friend says, look, I know you like him, I know you think he's good for you, you know, but you're less yourself around him there. But I'm happy. You go, well, you're wrong to be made happy by this. There's a different kind of happiness that would be better for you, you know. Your subjective feelings of happiness aren't the most reliable guide to what you should do. You need something, you know, a little more robust to ground them in. Because people, you know, you don't have to think anything about a different moral system is right to think that people in a culture are often made happy by hewing to their culture. And they'll tell you honestly, like, I'm happy as I am. I don't believe you that this, like, radical transformation will make me happier. And you and I, like, both think that they're wrong, that, you know, they would be made happier if they changed over, that their subjective beliefs are tricking them. But they'd say the same thing about us. So what do we appeal to say that we're actually correct, that our happiness, you know, is better, is grounded in something that's truer, more fulfilling, and they're not? They're not lying.
If I could come in on the side of Hemant at this point, and we'll let allow Hemant to respond as well. This area, which we've obviously got into now, the moral argument, a couple of people wanted to weigh in on this when I asked for people's opinions. Here's Andrew, who says, I think Andrew's coming from an atheist perspective here. He says, question for Leah, do you have any objective evidence that objective morality exists, or do you just feel very strongly that it does? So the question, I suppose, is, are you just going on a hunch, an intuition, that these things do exist, that there really is this objective morality out there?
I think the thing that it's often helpful for people to specify what class of evidence they're looking for. You know, there's the problem where people say no inductive proof is really a solid one. You can't say that you're certain the sun will rise tomorrow. You don't have any evidence about that. You only have evidence of what has happened up till this point in kind of the Hume objection. And I think that's a ridiculous standard of evidence to apply to everything, because then we end up kind of flailing around, unable to make any pronouncements. I'd say the way I feel about morality is the way someone who lived before we had a firm understanding of the physiology of the eye or the neuroscience of vision felt about sight. You know, I have some facility in me which receives data about these things, which does it immediately without an act of my will. I don't understand the precise mechanism of it, but I do receive these sensations. This is wrong. This is not. I can check them by kind of formalizing some of the systems in the same way that you can get tricked by optical illusions and then go, oh, I notice this is a flaw in the way I see. I'll have to be mindful of that in the future. And that's the way I approach morality, like vision, where I'm not adept in the physiology of it, but
you also used receive sight. A nice analogy on the CNN interview you did. You compared your view of morality to being that more of an archaeologist than an architect, that we discover laws that are already there rather than build our own laws from a sort of no foundation, as it were. Hemant, I mean, let's have you respond now. Are you any clearer? Is this making any more sense to you, or are you just still really...
No, none whatsoever. But I guess my question is still, even if this morality thing, even if you're saying there is this objective, this lawgiver whatsoever, what I think when people have talked to me about this, what they don't understand is how you jump from any of that philosophical stuff to the Pope is right, to saying the communion wafer is Jesus, to saying all these things that Catholicism says you have to believe in order to be a true Catholic. That's what we're not getting. It's that leap to Catholicism specifically over anything else.
And if I can also interrupt, just say John Humberstone agrees entirely with Hemant here. He Facebooked me and said, did you consider Islam? Leah, you know, I mean, what's wrong with Islam? You know, I suppose a lot of people will feel a little bit suspicious, Leah. You know, you were surrounded by these Catholic friends and all the rest of it. It was kind of the easy option to kind of segue into that community. Did you really have good rational reasons? Is that what you're getting at, Hemant, here? The rest of it might have a gloss of rationalism, but
I'm sure someone better versed in philosophy than me could battle back and forth between Leah on this morality thing. But to me, the thing I'm more interested in is where this leap to a very specific faith with a lot of very specific beliefs comes from, because I haven't heard that. I haven't seen that explanation. And I think when people are asking me about this story, they don't understand that one either.
We may be treading the same ground here, Leah, but again, why not Islam? You know, why not another brand of the Christian faith? Why this particular thing?
So I think the thing about coming to this through the morality thing is that, you know, again, contradeism, which just kind of, especially when applied to the physical world, doesn't give you much data about what kind of agent you're looking for, you know. What kind of key fits this lock? Coming to it through a moral argument means that I have some very strong expectations about what kind of God I've described or what kind of God, like, matches the problem I've explored. And the things I think about morality, virtue ethics, teleology, constrain what kind of God I might be talking about. And in my opinion, it constrains it in a way that looks a lot like the kind of God the Catholic Church is talking about.
It'd just be interesting, because one of the things that has been picked up in some of the interviews since you made this announcement, Leah, is that you've stated quite openly that you're bisexual in terms of your orientation. And many people are wondering, well, how does that work itself out in terms of wedding yourself to the Catholic Church? Just be interested in your take on that.
Yeah, so it's something that I'm having arguments with people about. You know, for me, this doesn't describe the experience of all queer people. I'm bisexual primarily because I just don't care very much about gender. It doesn't feel very salient to me. For me, like, straight people and gay people are like a little confusing, because it sounds like defining yourself by like not being attracted to redheads. And I know that's not other people's subjective experience, so I'm really not positing that it's as shallow as that for other people. But that's my experience. For me, honestly, like, the bigger question I'm trying to work out is, why does the Catholic Church think gender is so foundational to identity in the first place? And when I have more conversations about that, I'm sure you'll see more on my blog of me engaging with those specific arguments.
Another question before we come back to Hemant, and I think this is one that I would really like to ask as well, in a sense. Marianne asks, it's interesting that the issue of morality won her over to belief in God. Marianne's a Christian. She says, praise the Lord for that. Just wondering, though, did Leah convert to Catholicism because people were telling her that her beliefs lined up more with a Christian worldview? Or did she truly experience an authentic conversion of the heart and belief in Jesus Christ, the author of morality? In other words, was it a mental or a spiritual conversion, or in some way both? Because I think a lot of people are wondering, did you just kind of get convinced by a logical argument, or can you in some way say, no, I've met Jesus Christ, or use that kind of language about the experience you've had?
So I'm not a very emotionally engaged person, as maybe is clear from my style of speaking.
You're more of a right brain than a left brain person.
Or
is it the other way around? I can't remember.
I never remember. I have to look it up. But, you know, I don't really go in for pyrotechnics. So there is, like, I did have an emotional experience when I changed my mind. It felt a lot like the emotional experience I have doing my linear algebra homework, you know, where you're like, oh, I see the logic of this, you know, boom. And then it felt like a little more than that. But, you know, that's the kind of thing where I would say, you know, I could observe that whether I was right or wrong. It's more likely in the world where Christianity is true, but I see that as weak evidence, not really something that like I would use as a foundational piece of evidence.
So for you, in a sense, you're happy to admit it has been a sort of conversion of the mind rather than a sort of very emotional type of conversion. I was interested to read, though, on your blog that you talked about then, you know, having settled this, as it were, you went and listened to Mumford and Sons at full volume. You know, it sounds like something has possibly changed at some level on a sort of feeling at liberty to express a side that you had kind of been holding back up to that point. I don't know.
Well, I would say that I think people who think that intellectual conversions or like kind of just intellectual processes are these Spock-like emotionless things, it's like haven't done enough topology or math generally. It's extremely exhilarating. Everyone should read Flatland.
What's Flatland?
Flatland is this fabulous book by, I think it's Edwin Abbott or Edward Abbott, I forget, that's about a square that lives in a two-dimensional plane and is visited by a sphere. And the whole book is essentially a way to kind of teach you to think four-dimensionally by seeing how what a two-dimensional being would have to do to think three-dimensionally. And it's exhilarating. It's thinking in more, you know, dimensions than you're used to. And people are like, oh, I don't know, math, all those formulas, like, haven't been hitting the right bits of it, obviously.
So, somewhat like discovering another dimension, she says, Hemant. What's your response to all of this?
Flatland is a good book. I am very curious to know if, you know, Lee has been talking about this, writing about this for a few months. I'm wondering if any atheists have agreed with her, if anyone has said, you know, you've convinced me, I'm a Catholic too now.
Well, the answer to that is I had a couple people say, well, this is the most my Bayesian priors have shifted. because I run with a really weird group of people. There was someone who actually, before I converted, when people were accusing me of being a crypto-Catholic, just because of the morality of espousing, said that my blog helped him while he was converting to Catholicism, and he found some of the arguments I was making as an atheist help point him towards that. But, you know, a number of my friends kind of disagree back. Some of them disagree back where postmodernist friends think I can't say things about morality, period, you know, that it's like art. And we disagree far enough back that it's hard for me to sort of compel them on that point. One of my atheist friends wants to talk to me, well, two, I guess, if you count, I'm not going to say names, but, like, want to talk to me more about this, and I don't know that it will be compelling to them, but, like, it's compelling enough that they think it's worth a conversation.
No, one thing I found interesting is when I saw other Catholics writing about Leah's conversion, they never referenced any of the arguments she was making. They never referenced any of the philosophy she was talking about. They were specifically just kind of happy that she became a Catholic, which I found very telling, because even I don't think maybe they're in the same position I am, which is the argument that Leah is making doesn't make a lot of sense to them. So they just totally ignored it. They just said, hey, she's a Catholic now, so everyone else should become a Catholic too. Yeah, that's not going to work. It's not very convincing.
I think a lot of people, you know, were just counting coup, which is kind of contentless. Right. I also think, you know, it's not everyone, even if some people agree with the things I say, they don't put them in the same framework as I do, and then it's hard to translate out into like the less math-heavy analogies you're used to or something. This has been one of my favorite interviews because in a lot of them it's just like, so, like, how are you feeling about this? Because that's the easiest level to engage on. And I'm like, who cares how I'm feeling about this? Let's talk about, like, philosophy. And they're like, no, let's not do that. This is a five-minute piece, you know?
Well, I'm glad to give you some space. I mean, another question, and I don't know whether you could chime in on this, Hemant. A couple of people, both from an atheist and Christian perspective, asked this. Here's Rob, the way he put it. He says, I'm the last one to give her the no true Scotsman treatment. I believe she was an active atheist before her conversion to Catholicism, he says, but I do feel like it's been hyped up a bit. Peter Byram, on the other hand, asks, who's a Christian, says, have atheist friends and blog associates, have they reacted to the conversion? Have they given you the Anthony Flew treatment, that you've gone mad or suffered, the early onset of senility or something? You mentioned this already, Leah, that some people have said, well, you kind of actually stopped being an atheist a while ago, so this isn't really an atheist conversion. I mean, do you see it that way, Hemant? Are you convinced that Leah was a proper atheist before she converted?
Yeah, Leah said she was an atheist. She said she didn't believe in God, so she was an atheist. And any time I've heard anyone say otherwise, believe me, I've been the first person to correct them. So there's no issue there whatsoever. That part didn't bother me. That part didn't bother anyone else. And I have heard some atheists make comments like maybe, I did hear the Leah had a stroke argument. But again, those people, I'm not really taking seriously.
I mean, it is surprising, though, how often that does come up, because I remember...
Can I just add on the stroke argument? The funniest part of that is that someone commented, you know, on Hemant's original post, like, I think she had a stroke, and someone else goes, I don't know, she looks pretty young. Like, it's unusual for people that young to have strokes. And a third person comes in and says, well, look, like, I agree, it's very improbable. But, like, if you're weighing this against the odds that she's right, like, we have to admit that, like, less probable things, like, are still the most probable outcome. I'm like, that's, like, a good, like, layperson statistics discussion there going on. I appreciate that.
I remember when I had a conversation on this program a few years ago with a guy called Richard Morgan, who converted from very strong atheism to Christianity. He had been a member of the Richard Dawkins Forum and all sorts. And people accused him and they said, you must have had some kind of brain infarction. There must have, something's gone wrong in your brain. Hemant, I mean, you obviously don't get Leah's conversion, but
right.
you don't also appreciate people who say you've something funny's gone on in your brain.
Right. No, I mean, look, she has her reasons for turning Catholic, and I think the most telling thing is we'll see how many people follow her down that path. As far as I can tell, not many people are doing it, and I think that says something about how compelling that argument is. It's just not working. And the same thing happened with Anthony Flew, which is that, you know, he said he became a deist, and, convince us, because that's what we want to hear. Tell me why I should follow you down that path. I think atheists have done that very successfully with a lot of religious people, explaining why their beliefs aren't supported by the evidence. And again, like I said, if someone said, I used to be religious and I became an atheist, you probably wouldn't invite them on your show for that reason, because it happens all the time. We're very good at that.
Well, I often have people on the show who were religious and are now atheists. It happens.
Sure.
Yeah, but it obviously CNN don't pick it up. No, I don't.
No, I think one thing to note on the efficacy argument, or if I'm going to make the allusion to humans, kind of you'll know them by their converts argument, is that one thing I found frustrating when I was an atheist and still find frustrating is, you know, if you just convert someone away from a religion, you haven't necessarily converted them to a new moral system or metaphysics yet. And in my debate group, you know, it's not hard to make people sound stupid when you just, like, keep poking at them and going, well, because why? And we all thought it was, like, very bad form to make people nihilists. It was not nice to the freshmen. It's the easiest thing to do to a freshman, but it's, like, very bad form. Because you believe something, so you don't just want to make a negative case about what other people make. You want to make that positive case. Hemant and, I were talking about earlier with the moral thing about why your system or your heuristic for evaluating what ought to make people happy is the correct one. And I think atheists do a great job calling out some very, very destructive moral systems and getting people out of there as fast as possible can be the most important thing. I really like what one of the Pantheist bloggers, Livianne, does on addressing the Quiverful movement. But that's step one. Step two is persuading people to believe, you know, the new thing or whatever it is you do believe. And I think that there's a tendency to, like, behave like Republican strategists where you just attack whatever plan the other side's put forward.
We're gonna have
and don't
to
put
take,
your cards on the table.
We're going to have to take a quick break, and my apologies, and we're going to just wrap this up with a shorter finishing up in the next section of the program. We're talking today, my guest you just heard there, Leah Labresco, the atheist who converted to Catholicism recently, runs a blog, and she announced caused a lot of ripples in the atheist and Christian blogosphere, announced back in June that this was her last blog as an atheist. She was converting to Catholicism. Well, Hemant Mehta, the friendly atheist, runs his own blog of the same name, is talking to us as well about her conversion. We'll be back in a short moment's time here on the show that aims to get you thinking unbelievable. Welcome back to the final part of this week's Unbelievable, and we'll be hearing the end of the discussion between Leah Labresco, the atheist convert to Catholicism, and Hemant Mehta in a moment's time. If you want to come back at the same time next week, then what you'll be hearing is the first in two shows of a Mormon Christian dialogue. Obviously, we had the Jehovah's Witness dialogue recently, very popular, and we'll be hearing some of the feedback to that towards the end of today's show. But we're starting the first of two shows where we look at Mormonism. And our Mormon guest is going to be Charles Dayton, who's a regular listener to this program. And he's in conversation with Bobby Gilpin, again, part of partnership UK Partnerships for Christ that Tony Brown is part of as well. And Bobby's going to be interacting with Charles in the first show on the origins of Mormonism, Joseph Smith, the Book of Mormon, the whole story there, and of course on some of the current issues around the fact that Mitt Romney, the Republican candidate for the presidency, is of course a Mormon. So that should be a really interesting show to kick off those two shows of a dialogue from next week. Don't forget, you can also of course listen back at any time to the shows that we have here on Unbelievable via the website, where there is a huge backlog of past programs. Some people actually work their way, I've discovered, through the podcast, literally listening to three or four shows a week if they've only just discovered. But premier.org.uk/unbelievable for all the links you want to today's show, to past shows, to other features and resources, including of course Unbelievable, the conference on DVD, fabulous three discs of teaching. And I do hope you avail yourself of that if you are at all interested in Christian apologetics, evidence for the Christian faith, and how to share it in a skeptical world. premier.org.uk/unbelievable for all the links. Do keep listening as well once this conversation we've been having today is finished, because I want to tell you, as well as feedback to the last few weeks of programming, about the Atheist Prayer Experiment, something you may be interested in if you're an atheist. Will you help us with the Atheist Prayer Experiment? All will be revealed after we conclude today's program with Leah Labresco, our former atheist, now a Catholic, and Hemant Mehta, continuing atheist blogger.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, coming back to you, Hemant, just like your final thoughts, really, on all of this. I don't know whether what it would take to convince you. You know, you spent a year going into churches, didn't you? You say you didn't come across anything that you found convincing. What would it take to get you to the position that Leah has adopted?
Maybe I have to have some sort of internal conflict that I just can't resolve through my atheism or something. I remember when I went to those churches, they don't go after your mind. They go after your heart. They go after that community. And they make it so that when you belong to their church, they will take care of you if you lose your job or you lose a loved one or you need a place to go. They got you covered on that stuff. They shy away from the intellectual stuff because it's not compelling. No one cares about what the philosophical arguments are. I mean, and there are believe me, we should have those conversations. But that's not what they do in churches. They don't care about the intellectual. They're going to lose on the intellectual.
Well, I just for my own part, Hemant, I run a show which deals specifically with the intellectual arguments for Christianity, and so I fully acknowledge there are many churches which simply don't engage. I think, though, there's a growing movement. I was going to say, I think there is a growing movement within churches, and it depends really on where you go. But Leah, I mean, would you broadly agree with Hemant's assessment of the way most Christians approach their faith, the way churches tell people about God?
I think many people don't approach most things in their life in an intellectual fashion, and religion is no exception to that. But the thing I find kind of frustrating or confusing about Hemant's statement is whether or not you think Christianity is true, you would expect that there's an intellectual current in it. There have been a lot of smart people engaged with it. They didn't turn their brains off while they were, you know, Gregor Mendel didn't only think about plants. So when you say that, I think there's not content in there, it sounds like that's not something you would actually expect, even if it's false. Like you would expect people to rationalize and then still have like things that at least on the surface seem intellectually deep. And when you don't expect that, then I'm not surprised you aren't finding it.
No, but I think if there is an intellectual current behind it, then you're going to win or lose based on your ability to make that point to other people. I have not seen that point be very effective yet. So I think what remains, I mean, what we have to see is, okay, as Leah writes about this stuff, as other people who say they have these intellectual arguments for what they believe in terms of religion, as they're making these arguments, you want to see how many people are following them down that road. Can they be persuaded by that evidence, by that logic? Right now, I haven't seen that happen. But I think that's the question you want to ask yourself, as we all want to ask ourselves as we move forward. You know, are people going down that path with her? Are they convinced? If they're not, then, you know, what good does it do if just one person is persuaded by that person's own argument?
Well, and I think that the thing that's the greatest obstacle to kind of the best arguments winning out is the rise of the postmodernist idea that these intellectual ideas are more like aesthetics than things that are compelling.
Explain a bit more what you mean by that, Leah.
Like the thing that makes it hardest to have these arguments or to convince people of things that you think are true is the idea that no one needs to be convinced by other people because it's all just preference or description. But we don't have an expectation that true arguments will win out. And I'm glad that Hemant shares my assumption that, like, there is some truth that people have access to and that the more they engage honestly, the more likely they are to come to the right conclusion. That's not what I hear all the time when people say, oh, right for me, not right for you. The most important thing is just, like, not bothering that other people disagree and living your own life.
I mean, I have to say, Hemant, I run into a lot of atheists who also have non-rational reasons for being atheists. You know, I don't say it's as though all atheists have really rational reasons for being atheists and Christians don't. I just think you'll find a mixture of both in both camps, won't you?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. There are people who don't believe in God probably for the wrong reasons.
Well, we'll probably going to have to leave it there, both. Thank you so much for being with us. Leah, if people want to find out more about your story and follow your blog, where should they go to?
They should go to www.unequally-yoked.com.
Fantastic. And if people want to find out more about the Friendly Atheist, Hemant, where should they be?
Friendlyatheist.com.
Fantastic. Thank you both so much for joining me on the program today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Justin.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, I hope you enjoyed today's show. And as usual, if you want to get in touch, respond to anything you heard on today's programme, all the usual methods apply. You can email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or you can phone, leave me a voicemail message, 08456 52 52 52, and select the option to leave a voicemail for Unbelievable. And don't forget, I'd like to hear your opinions on today's show via the social media networks. Twitter, @UnbelievableJB is my handle, and I do enjoy interacting with people that way. You can also, of course, get in touch via the Facebook page, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB. But the links are all available, of course, from the Unbelievable website, premier.org.uk/UnbelievableJB. Unbelievable. So look forward to hearing from you there. Now, before we get into some of your feedback to the last couple of weeks of what has been a really popular couple of programs in a Jehovah's Witness dialogue with a Christian, we want to tell you about the Atheist Prayer Experiment. So this is hot off the press. There's really not much online about it yet, but we'll add some information as we go along. But if you're an atheist, you're listening today, I'd really like to invite you to take part in this experiment. Tim Mawson is a Christian philosopher in Oxford, and he wrote a paper that said that atheists should, on balance, pray to God to reveal himself to them. And you can read the paper and you'll find out exactly why he argues for that. Well, we're going to be inviting Tim onto the programme to talk about that paper with an atheist philosopher. But we thought it would be really interesting to actually do something practical about it and actually maybe try it in practice to see what happens when atheists do what Tim suggests they should do in this paper. They pray to God to reveal himself to them. So what we're going to be asking atheists, if they're willing to do, is for the period of 40 days from September through to October to pray for a few minutes each day over a 40-day period and to, as honestly as they can, ask God to reveal himself to them in whatever way, as it were, makes most sense for them to pray that. And there are some suggestions in Tim's paper. So if you'd be interested in taking part in this and documenting any thoughts, any responses, any potential answers to prayer that you may feel you had or equally did not have, then we'd be really interested in hearing from you and so that we can put your experience up as part of the programme. And I think it'll just be a fascinating way of interacting with the subject of prayer, atheism and what Christians believe about it. So if you want to take part in this, I do encourage you to email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. What I'll do is I'll email you back. I won't be able to do that immediately. We're still sorting out some of the details. But email me and I will get back to you with sort of just an idea of what we're looking for if you're going to take part in this experiment. And I'll email you Tim's paper as well so you can read for yourself the argument he puts forward as to why atheists should pray for God to reveal himself to them. And we'll see how many people we can get together to take part in the Atheist Prayer Experiment. And we're going to be launching it properly in September. So if you want to get on board, do feel free to email me and we'll be glad to send you the information about what taking part means. And do send it on to others who you think might be interested. The Atheist Prayer Experiment coming soon to Unbelievable from September onwards. So that's all very exciting. Do hope to hear from you if you're an atheist and you're interested in taking part. But we've had loads of response. And as usual, I haven't left myself enough time to get to half of it to the Jehovah's Witness shows of the last 2 weeks. We had Tony Brown, a ex-Jehovah's Witness, talking to Robert King, a disfellowship Jehovah's Witness, but who holds to the core doctrines of the Jehovah's Witnesses. Thanks very much indeed to Mike, who got in touch with me. He's in Devon and he wanted to send me some audio recordings that he had on tape of some of the at least one key person in the Jehovah's Witnesses, Judge Rutherford, who was president of the Watchtower Society from 1917 to 1942. This is in regard to whether the Watchtower Society made prophecies which failed. Well, as you'll hear, this is a very rough sort of audio. This is from 1938 and a speech that Judge Rutherford made called Fill the Earth. So I apologise for the sound quality. We'll just pay a minute or so of this, though, because in this, as Mike says, Judge Rutherford is talking to the Jonadab, which means the earthly class of Jehovah's Witnesses, the majority, as opposed to the 144,000 who had the heavenly hope. And in it, Judge Rutherford is telling people not to get married or have children until after the Armageddon, which was expected to take place in the very near future. Now, if a young couple, say 20 years old at the time, had taken his advice, they'd be 94 now and somewhat past the joys he was promising them. So let's just hear a little bit of this speech that Mike managed to dig out from an archive he had somewhere in his loft and has kindly been able to send over to me.
Are now on earth, Jonadab's delivered to the Lord, who doubtless will prove faithful. Would it be scripturally proper for them to now marry and to begin to rear children? No, is the answer, which is supported by the scriptures. The scriptures fully support the conclusion that the filling of the earth is not due to begin before, but after Armageddon. The words of Jesus further support this conclusion, to wit, and woe unto them that are with child, and them that give suck in those days of Armageddon. It is the grand privilege of the Jonadabs to now see that the kingdom is here, and it is their bounded duty, if they would live, to fully support the kingdom, and to do what the Lord has commanded them to do, which is to seek meekness and righteousness, and to join forces with the remnant and give testimony to the world according to and concerning the kingdom of God under Christ. It will be far better to be unhampered and without burdens of children, that they may do the Lord's work now as the Lord commands, and also without an hindrance during Armageddon. Those Jonadabs who now contemplate marriage, it would seem, would do better if they wait a few years until the fiery storm of Armageddon is gone, and to then enter the marital relationship and enjoy the blessings of participating in filling the earth with her righteous and perfect people as God commands.
Thank you very much. As you can tell, obviously a bit difficult probably to pick out those words, but you probably managed to get the gist of it, that at that time in 1938, certainly the Jehovah's Witnesses were being urged not to marry if they hadn't already, because of the coming Armageddon. Well, again, Mike, you sent me another one. This was the Sanatco 1967. This was a talk given at an area convention in 1967 called Serving with the Everlasting Life in View by an official Watchtower representative called Brother Sanatco. Here is a spoken reference to 1975, the year the Watchtower was prophesying that Armageddon was to take place. And so this is Sanatco talking about that coming Armageddon in 1975, in the year 1967.
Well, now, as Jehovah's Witnesses, as runners, even though some of us have become a little weary, it almost seems as though Jehovah has provided meat in due season, because he's held up before all of us a new goal, a new year, something to reach out for, and it just seems has given all of us so much more energy and power in this final burst of speed for the finish line. And that's the year 1975. In the 1967 issue of the Watchtower, we read, what does the year 1975 mean for humankind? The end of 6,000 years of human existence, and possibly the time when God executes the wicked and starts off a 1,000-year reign under his Son, Jesus Christ, unquote. As far as knowing for sure, well, we know what we know for sure. We just read it. The end of 6,000 years of human history, and possibly the execution of the wicked in the beginning of the 1,000-year reign. And that should be exciting enough and talk enough for us. When you think about it, what a fantastic short span of time that is. How little time there is left. How much to happen. And we hope that all of us here tonight are going to listen to the society's imploring. We're going to listen to their agonizing entreaty. Brothers, get in, because they know what's coming. And it's coming fast. And don't wait till 75. The door is going to be shut before then.
There you go. A little clearer that time, but again, you get the point. These were sent through by Mike to show that many current Jehovah's Witnesses don't know the history of the Watchtower and Bible Society, and there are many examples of false prophecy from Russell onwards, of the hypocrisy of the leaders and of the headquarters staff leaving when they realised that the truth was not being taught. Thank you for sharing that with me, Mike, and taking the trouble to put it down on in an MP3 format. Let's go to some more of your feedback as well. Doug Rowlings in Canada said, I really enjoyed the two shows on Jehovah's Witnesses. I've been a Christian apologist since 1983 and have had hundreds of discussions with cultists. One question that I've come up with that always makes them stop talking and think is, do you know the difference between what you believe and I believe? You believe the road to paradise, or heaven, depending on who I'm talking to, is a ladder. And I believe it's an elevator. When they ask me what I mean, I tell them that when they ask Jesus into their lives, that they believe they are put on a ladder. After they're on the ladder, they must go up a rung at a time. Each rung, a good work, and they have to keep doing works if they want to go to paradise or heaven. Then I tell them that I believe the road to heaven is actually an elevator. By asking Christ into my life, I'm put on the elevator and it goes up by a power greater than myself. I'm free to do good works. But they don't make the elevator go up. Of course, I do good works because God has work for me to do, but they're not for salvation. Why wouldn't I do good works if God lives in me? Every time I've used this with a Jehovah's Witness or Mormon or whoever, they stop talking, sit there and think. I found it to be a particularly powerful tool in reaching out to cultists. Well, thank you, Doug. That was a very interesting analogy, and thanks for sending that one in. Also getting in touch is Roberto Baruffi on Jesus and Michael the Archangel. That was the subject of last week's show. Was Jesus God, or was he simply the Archangel Michael, as Jehovah's Witnesses believe? Roberto says, I have a conundrum for Jehovah's Witnesses with regard to the deity of Jesus. There is this belief that the person of Jesus was Michael the Archangel. But do you agree that Jesus came to die for our sins so we may be forgiven and reconciled for God? If that's true, then we're a little confused with something we read in Scripture with regard to the new covenant that Jesus came to inaugurate. I understand that Jehovah's Witnesses say that according to Scripture, Jesus cannot be God, but that he was Michael the Archangel. Now, with regard to covenants, in Galatians 3:20, we read, Now a mediator is not for one party only, whereas God is only one. So according to this scripture, we see that under normal circumstances, whenever a covenant was made, two parties would normally be involved in the making of it. However, in Genesis 15, we also read that when God made a covenant with Abraham, only he took part in the proceedings. Well, in this passage, we see how it was typically done, and there we also read that only God was took part in the proceedings. He alone walked through the animals that were cut into pieces. Now, this is where my confusion lies. We've just noticed that only God took part. Now, the conundrum question, who alone could be qualified to mediate for God except God himself? That's one party. And who could mediate for us humans except another human being that we could look up to or at least consider worthy of our trust? That's two parties. Moreover, since Michael the Archangel was a created being and therefore not equal to God, could you explain how he could possibly have become the mediator of a new covenant as the person of Jesus, who, although now human, could mediate for us humans but could not possibly be qualified to mediate for God? That's the question Roberto wants Jehovah's Witnesses to answer. If God, Jesus really wasn't God, how he possibly fulfills the what the atonement is supposed to do. Thank you very much. Just time for one more message. I think we'll play a phone message now. This came from a person who was listening, a listener, who wanted to get in touch with their story of being a former Jehovah's Witness. This is a little time I'm giving over to this one, but listen, I think you'll find this really interesting.
Hi, Justin. My name is Janet Pusey. I was in the Jehovah's Organization going on for nearly 17 years. My personal experience was that, because I haven't got a family that really cares and things like that, so when they came, they were all over me and they gave me lots of Bible instructions. I love the Lord with all my heart. And, you know, they gave me lots of Bible instructions. We wasn't allowed to talk to Jesus, and I found that so difficult. It was only addressing our prayers only had to be addressed to Jehovah God. My main problem was with them is that I'm a very friendly person, a very loving person. I was very sensitive at the time as well, but and also I was very ill. I still get very ill, so I couldn't get out to the field service and to the meetings as often as I was supposed to. I was terrified, you know, but I didn't fit in because I was so sick all the time, and people hardly came around to visit me. We wasn't allowed to be friends of people that weren't Jehovah's Witnesses, so I didn't have any friends. And I was regarded as a weak person because I was hardly out on the ministry. So therefore, they didn't want to mix with me that much. And I did find that Jehovah's Witnesses, they talk a lot about love, give you a lot of love when you first come in, and then withdraw. You know, they were all for the work and getting their hours in. You know, the more hours you got in, the more you got favoured by Jehovah, and everything was so conditional. I have now dissociated myself from them, and I went away and like prayed for 2 years, because like you're so indoctrinated into being told that that is the only way, is in Jehovah's organisation. I'm going to listen to your program with interest.
Well, thank you very much for getting in touch. Very glad you were able to feel able to share that story. And if you want to get in touch yourself in regard to anything you've heard on today's programme or responding to any of the feedback on today's show, then do, of course, get in touch via the usual methods. unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the email address. And just a reminder, that's also the email if you want to take part in the atheist prayer experiment that I was talking about earlier on in the show. And I'd be delighted to send you some more information about it if you get in touch with me about that. For the moment, we're out of time, I'm afraid. And so what that means is we're going to tell you about what's coming up next week on the programme. And I do hope you'll join us for that.
You're unbelievable.
It's a Mormon-Christian dialogue next week. Our Mormon guest is Charles Dayton, who's actually a listener of Unbelievable. He got in touch with me quite a while back now, saying that he was a Mormon and enjoyed listening to the show. Well, kindly he's agreed to come on and represent, not as it were, be an official representative of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, but really someone who has an understanding of where they stand and is a layperson within the church and would just like to share his perspective on the whole area of Mormonism. And he'll be in conversation with Bobby Gilpin. Bobby runs a ministry to Mormons, and he goes out to Utah regularly, but he's based here in the UK, and they'll have a fascinating conversation on the origins of Mormonism next week. So I hope you can join me for that, same time, same place, here on Premier Christian Radio, Saturday afternoon, 2:30 p.m. And don't forget, you can listen back anytime you want at the website, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Until next week, I hope you have a good one. I'm Justin Brierley. I'll see you next time.